listener production. Jack Riewoldt is a former professional Australian Football League player and two-time premiership player with the Richmond Football Club.
Look at that! Riewoldt makes it three in a row.
He's given it a decent ride, Jack Riewoldt. Oh, you can't believe it, can you?
Jack Riewoldt, fearless as ever.
Known for his exceptional skills on the field and his leadership off it.
Number 8, Jack Riewoldt.
In the conversation that follows, we discuss the resilience required to achieve success at the highest level of sport, how he navigated the waves of grief after his cousin Maddie died, his response to the Adam Goods booing drama, and what it was like to retire from a sport he has dedicated his life to.
See the bottom and sort of then start to rise a little bit and have that really peak period of success, but then that little dip again at the end where you get to then go, oh, that was awesome. Saw a lot of my best mates retire. I saw a coach that had led us to success finish up. And all those little things, whilst they were sad moments, they're great reflective moments as well. How awesome that moment was with that person then, I think it gives you a great recipe to know what you can do when you get everything together and you get everyone pushing in the right direction and how successful you can be. It really is a recipe for success.
I'm Sarah Grimberg, and this is A Life of Greatness. Through my years of studying and researching the connection between human behaviour, personal growth, and transformation, I have discovered the keys to unlocking greatness within others. In this podcast, I share stories and experiences from my own teachings, along with conversations with inspiring guests to help you learn the simple tips, habits, practices and strategies to cultivate an extraordinary existence. Jack is the author of his most recent book, The Bright Side. My hope is that this conversation empowers you to embrace your own journey of relentless persistence and cultivate the never quit drive necessary to accomplish extraordinary things. You say talent for sport is just as much nature as nurture. Why do you believe that to be?
You're a product of your environment, really. For me, I've got two younger brothers. Both my parents are PE teachers. So, I mean, I love sport. And being the eldest of three boys, I think there's always an element of competition about that, whether that be playing sport or just in life in general. So, there is also things that can change as well. Like I think I look at grit and think that you can probably certainly change how gritty you are. But fundamentally, there's a lot of things that are ingrained in us from an early age.
What bit do you think is nature?
There's probably elements of physical performance, your genetics and your DNA and what you can do. Yeah, I think that would probably be the things that would probably be most reflective or most important in football.
Yes. Your mum was a great basketballer and your dad a footballer. Your uncles were footballers and your cousin Nick was one as well. Tell us a bit about your childhood.
Well, as I said, my parents are both PE teachers, so they had a love for sport. My mum played basketball for Tassie and the old man played footy for Clarence and had the chance to play AFL, or VFL at the time, but didn't take that opportunity up and stayed in Tasmania to finish his uni degree. And I think that was life for me, really. It was just growing up and playing sport. I mean, I didn't start playing footy until I was sort of 13 years of age. Yeah. And I loved other things. I loved soccer. Yeah. Soccer was our sport. And I think I tried everything. I did little athletics. I did soccer. I did football. I did water polo. It was just whatever I could do. I must have been a nightmare for my parents to drive me around to all these things. And then considering that there was another two of us, there was three of us in total. And they were extremely busy, but it was a good day when I got my license and I could drive myself to a lot of these things at 17 years of age.
I'm realizing that now with my kids. Like, it's like the weekends change and it's not about what you want to do anymore. It's about like schlepping one here, taking another there, and your whole weekend is just extracurricular activities. But you kind of embrace that in the end and it becomes just something that you get used to. But I think it's funny, isn't it? Because it's not till we have kids do we really like reflect on that and how amazing our parents are that they're sacrificing their weekends and their weeks to just take us to practice.
It actually is a really good point that I actually don't reckon you realise how, and this is not in a bad way at all, but how selfish you are until you have to look after someone else. And it sounds a bit sort of over the top, but it is really life or death with a baby if you look after them. Like, you have to look after them. But we're starting to enter that space in our lives where there's a kids party every week. And it just is what it is. It becomes a part of your life and a part of your weekends. And I think as monotonous as they can be when you're just constantly going to 2-year-old and 4-year-old birthday parties, it's the build up and then the party for your children. It's the only thing on their minds, and they'll talk about it for weeks on end, pre and post events, that you're creating core memories.
When you reflect on your parents, especially now, obviously, your football career has ended, what are you grateful for when you think of your younger years?
I was a very out there child.
How?
My mother is a very artsy person. While she worked as a PE teacher for a period of time there, she was then a florist. And so at school holidays would roll around, and Mum was really big on promoting us to just be ourselves and be creative. And growing up in I say regional, but it was pretty simple Hobart where we grew up. We grew up in Belrive, and I can think now, my parents used to let us get on a bus at sort of 12, 10 and 8. That were our ages. And we'd jump on a bus and travel 20 Ks south to go to the local skate park. They just give us $10 and they say, right, we'll see you when you get back. Which I obviously have lived in Melbourne now for 17 years. You go, oh, that was an amazing way to grow up.
Mm.
We've just bought a shack on the east coast of Tassie, and we're going there for a period of time at the end of this year. And my sole driver behind that is to create core memories for my kids and afford them, whilst they're not at the age that we were when we were doing that sort of stuff, but actually afford them the opportunity to just go out and explore and allow them that element of freedom so that it's not always this protective environment in a big metropolis where around every corner you're worried that something's lurking or whatever it is. It's just a case of, it's quite homely to just let your kids go and explore and find things out for themselves rather than you leading them to all the things in their lives.
I think that is so important. What age were you when you started playing professional football?
So I started playing professional football when I was 18. I probably played semi-professional before that. So the first time I ever got paid to play footy, I was 15. $50 a game for a 15-year-old. I was pretty quick to tell mum and dad that was it for household chores. But no, full-time professional when I was 18 years of age. So I had my 18th birthday and got drafted about 2 weeks after that and moved to Melbourne straight away.
And then tell me, when was your first game for Richmond?
My first game for Richmond was round 9, 2007. It was quite a special game, actually. It was obviously my first game, but played in Dreamtime at the G was my first game. We played Essendon, which has become a huge cultural piece, not only in the footballing calendar, but I think the Australian calendar of what it means to Australia, the Dreamtime game. I've been lucky enough to be a part of it now. I've played in 16 of them that every year it rolls around, and whilst it's quite special to me to be a part of an organisation that's really forward thinking on First Nations culture and its involvement in our workplace, but then also it's a bit of a reminder of where it all started for me in that first ever game in front of sort of 80,000 people at the MCG.
He's going to give it a ride. From 55, Revolt long bomb. Got the journey. Oh, what a kick. Great goal.
What do you think about what the crowds did? And they've done it to a few people, but you bring up Indigenous now with Adam Goods. What are your thoughts on that?
It's a bugbear of mine. Like, I've been booed as well, and jeered and whatnot, and had certain things said to me across the fence.
Like what?
All sorts of things. I'll tell you that part of it before I talk about the booing is I really struggled with people not liking me but not knowing you and then not liking you. That was the hard thing for me. And then I finally sort of started to click that it was not my problem. And to this day, probably, well, definitely people would still have a, and I don't use this term loosely, they have a probably a hatred towards me and other players, or a dislike towards other players, purely for the fact that they wear different colours, which is mind-boggling. The fact that I have worked for an organisation that has yellow and black, which people just have a hatred for Richmond. So then anything to do with Richmond, they hate Richmond. And it finally started to dawn on me that it's not my issue.
Mm.
But the booing thing, there's a bigger piece at play here where it's a pile-on mentality, where it starts as it might start as a small rumbling, and clearly people can see that it's antagonizing someone. So then they jump on board and they start to just, and there's that, this is nearly a bit of a bully mentality, but there's certainly a gang mentality about it where it just keeps going. And people don't like being told to not do something. And I think that there's a whole bunch of reasons behind booing. Fundamentally though, that someone said, "Hey, can you please not do that to me?" And people just didn't listen.
And doesn't that show you the darkness of human nature as well? Like, footy's supposed to bring people together and be this sport, it's competitive, but that's the fun bit about it. But then when you're booing someone for their race or whatever it is, and it's not just one person, but there's nearly like half a stadium doing it, to me, that is the lowest of the low.
It's extremely poor form. And I think there's elements of tall poppy syndrome, probably in Australia more so than some other countries, where there's people of significance ingrained in people's minds is the want to cut them down.
Mm.
And they will find any sort of way to do that. I think the AFL and its people would look back on what happened with Adam Goods, and it would leave an extremely sour taste in their mouth that they didn't act harder. But the thing with this is, and sometimes it's really hard, because if the AFL come out and say, "Hey, don't do that," people are going to be like, "No, you know what? Stick it up the AFL. We're going to do it even more now." So how do you find the balancing act? And I suppose the act of asking for decency is the one thing, and people will, you will never convince everyone. There's people out there that will think that the fact that they pay $50 to go to the game of footy gives them carte blanche what they want to do, and they can say whatever they want to say because they've paid to go in there, which is flawed and wrong, but that's the view that some people take when they attend sporting events.
Why did they boo you?
I think it's a little bit probably just to do with playing for Richmond. But I've done stuff that's been probably divisive for people. I've been sometimes quite vocal on certain things, but some people don't like me because I show passion on the football field. Now I've learned to curb that, and I've matured and learned how to restrain and also not overreact to minor things. But there's always, like, I've probably cried more than I've on the football field, or cried more about things in the back end of my career, whereas stuff like that in the front of my career when I was a little bit younger and I'd had less life experiences would have come out as a real aggression. Mm. I mean, emotion just isn't anger. It can be a whole bunch of a range of emotions. Like, it can be extreme happiness, which I think of some of the stuff I've done in grand finals after kicking goals, and that's just pure adulation. Or it can be extreme sadness, where things in my life have affected how I feel when I sort of go out to play footy. So emotion just always isn't anger, which I think sometimes people sort of think goes hand in hand.
What are the mindset, like, what are the tools that you learned to understand that you don't care what people think, and especially not ones that know you?
Yeah, I think working in the media gave me a better output on that. and life lessons. So like I said something about the way we were playing in 2012 and really bungled that up, became a bit of a sort of, it was a sort of like police chase basically with the media trying to chase me through the streets of Richmond. And I sort of sat back and on reflection on that, I'm like, hey, what's the worst thing that can happen if you walk out and face the music? So on the flip side of that is that when we went to the Gold Coast in 2020 and we had a few things as a club go wrong, I was always in the background going, hey, just go out and we are sorry about what happened to you. Say you're sorry. We can't change the way people accept our apology. We can say that we can say we're sorry and we're heartfelt and we're really, really, we don't want this to happen. We had a few little issues up there. But still, it's on the person listening or receiving the apology to either accept it and move on or dwell on it and not accept the apology. We can't influence that.
Obviously, family is a big thing to you. It's a beautiful thing. So, you know, you're lucky to have a big family and one that sounds like they're beautiful and great people. In 2010, your cousin Maddie was diagnosed with aplastic anemia. And in 2013, you got tested and were a perfect match for a platelet donor. In your new book, The Bright Side, you write, Maddie fought aplastic anemia for more than 4 years. When her family asked if I would be tested to see if I could become a platelet donor, I agreed. Of course, my O negative blood type made me compatible, and then the process began. And with every little medical step and the reality sunk in a little deeper, I needed steroid injections to maximize the harvest of my platelets. For instance, I needed WADA permission to take injections during pre-season. 2 days later, I was walking into a hospital past terminally ill people and those requiring transfusions for dire ailments. I sat there for 4 hours, surrounded by people trying to stay alive. How was that time?
Oh, it's brutal. It was a really difficult time for my family and also my extended family. So I did this, and we did this exercise called Hero, Hardship and Highlight in 2017. It's one of the catalysts of the revolution of Richmond and the success of Richmond. And we spoke about, obviously, a hero in our life. We spoke about a hardship. We spoke about the highlight. And my highlight was actually that point in time in my life. The fact that it was also my hardship, Madeline passing away eventually. But there's an element of being bulletproof as a young male, I think, that sometimes, and also someone who's engages in professional sport, in a combative sport, you start to develop a sense of bulletproofness. And I had that taken away from me pretty quickly as well. It was like, holy crap, my life's changed, because in my circle of influence, in my family circle, someone's been really affected. So you're a little bit lost there, as we all were as a family, on how to help Maddie. And then this, obviously the option came up to donate platelets, and like I was a compatible match. I think Nick was as well, and so were my two brothers. So it was really this moment of our family sort of coming together to actually try and make amends on something. As the like this real sense of team. Now, I don't, like, you look at it and you think, oh, it didn't work because Maddie passed away, but maybe it gave her a little bit longer to be here. And you really sort of, you, as I was walking through the chair, I vividly remember sitting in the chair, and they hook you up and literally pump your blood through and harvest platelets as they pump your blood in, you pump your blood out. And there's people just sitting there on dialysis or on treatments for cancer, and you look at these people and you think, fuck, they're in for the fight of their lives here. Like, are they lucky enough to have people in the background trying to help them, or are they literally riding this out by themselves? Because a lot of people get crook and they don't even tell anyone because they don't want to put a burden on other people, and they think, oh, I'll fight the battle by myself. So you sort of, it's like you, the range of emotions that you ride in that little roller coaster when you're sitting there and you're like, because it's 4 hours, you sit, and in the grand scheme of things, it's not a long time, but to sit there and be in a really clinical place like a hospital, you think of a lot of things and you see a lot of things that change your thought patterns. And that was a really, like a really sort of thought-provoking time, just sitting there and just going, shit, like am I doing a good job of cutting platelets? Like, you got no idea. Is this working? What's that person up to? You see a family come in, we see younger people, older people, and it really, really is quite thought-provoking in terms of the lens that you see it through.
You went to training, you know, you found out on the way to training that she had passed, and you didn't tell anyone. And then it was Damien Hardwick who saw you like in the stairwell, and he noticed that something was wrong.
Yeah, so I was driving into work, and I knew Mads was crook, like really crook. But we'd been through a couple of those sort of like, let's call them last moments, a few times, and she'd fought through. So there's always this thing in the back of your mind, you're like, she'll be right. Like, it's, yeah, you don't want to believe it. But yeah, my father rang me and told me as I was driving up Hunt Road across Swan Street, actually, just about to go under the bridge of the Richmond train station, and I sort of slowed down and pulled into the car park and sat in the car for, I don't know how long I sat in the car for, maybe sort of 15, 20 minutes, and rang Carly, my wife, and you sort of just sit there in silence, and there's elements of disbelief. There's obviously huge elements of sadness, and you ask all those questions that I'm sure people ask and have asked when a traumatic event happens, like, why us, why her, what did we do to deserve this? And then I think I probably went into a little bit of just a zombie mode, really, where it's just like in that sort of fight or flight, you sort of just, I just got caught in a trance, really, and went into the club and was just, how do you cope? What's your coping mechanism here? And for me, it was just, I've just got to go to work. I've literally got to go to work. But I mean, as an emotional person, which we've established here, that I'm no good at hiding it. Yeah, so I went in and was walking down the hallway, and the first person I bumped into was coach. He's like, "You're right," and I was like, "Oh, Maddie's just died," and he's like, "What the fuck are you doing here?" And I was like, I said, I don't know what to do. I don't know what to do. And he's like, "Mate, go home." And I was like, I don't want to. Because like, I'd go home and I'd be sitting there in my own thoughts again. So footy clubs can be the best places in the world. And a lot of the times they are the best places in the world. And that was a point in time where I needed people around me, and they rally around their own, and they rally around others. And that time I needed them. When my family live in Tassie, I really am only here with Carly and the other kids. But I needed my extended family, and the football club are certainly a part of that. And they were there for me.
What did Maddie's death teach you about living?
I think there's an element of just, one, not giving up. And the tagline for Maddie's vision is obviously fight like Maddie. So Maddie was in ICU for, I think it was like over 200 days. And ICU, and some of the listeners may have been unfortunate enough to go in there and see people or been in there themselves, is that you're under ICU and it's a short stay or you don't come out, basically, which is quite brutal, but that is what intensive care unit is. It's the worst of the worst. And to battle through that for such a long time and just be constantly fighting and not giving up and being on death's door, but just never giving in, never giving in. That's just taught me a level of persistence. There's also just the element of passion. So Maddie was frightfully passionate, ferociously passionate, I'll say, about a few things. One was Liverpool, the Liverpool Football Club. Two was the St Kilda Football Club, and third was me. So I think the catch cry came that she'd always hoped that I'd kick a bag against the Saints, but the Saints would win just. So, I mean, it's really funny that, I mean, there isn't many Revolt girls. We're probably a lineage of boys, like myself. I'm one of three boys. Nick has a brother, Alex, and obviously I had Maddie. Our dads are two of four boys. Nick had three boys, and then I've got a couple of girls and a young son. And the fact that Carly's been here, my wife's been here through the whole journey as well. So she knew Maddie as well as I knew Maddie, and her and Maddie got on like a house on fire. And then those sort of the lessons that we all learn as a family through the really difficult times. But the great bits about Maddie is you try and instill them in your own children. You try and instill them in your own girls, because there's that just element of just maddiness, which was just so combative, so not worrying about what anyone else thought. And we loved her for that. We just loved her for that. So honest. And you try and instill that in your own children because you know it's a great trait and a great value to have.
Mm. Mindset is a big thing when it comes to any sport. And I know that Richmond were they put a lot of emphasis on that. And they got a lot of people to come in and talk to you guys about mindset, and Murray being one of them who's actually been on this podcast. And that changed things a lot for you guys. And then you started doing meditation, and you can talk a bit about the other things that you learned. But how was that time, and what actually flicked the switch?
Yeah, so I reckon Richmond probably is extremely progressive in this area. And it's like a snowball, I think, that once you get just that little bit of momentum going, and it's important where it starts as well. So if it starts from influential people, now they don't have to be the oldest, they don't have to be the most liked, but if it starts from influential people, it starts to roll down the hill, and as a snowball rolls, it gathers momentum and also gathers size. So for us, it started probably a little bit with Dylan Grimes and David Asprey doing some work with Emma. Emma's had her own trials and tribulations. I guess son Will jumped off a pontoon and broke his neck and is now disabled and a quadriplegic. And that happened at a really pivotal time as well, where it was Emma became a part of us and then all of a sudden needed our help. And we were asking her for a lot of stuff. We're like, oh, can you help us perform? Can you help us perform? And then all of a sudden the table just got completely flipped, where it was like, holy shit, we need to help her. We need to help her and her family. And that was through, we raised a chunk of money for some stuff for Will. But then this relationship started where it was just information sharing, information gathering, and just there would be toing and froing with the way we would we would engage with Emma and people that she brought into the football club. That whilst this has always been said to be a performance mindset angle, it really was life-altering for a lot of people in terms of the tributaries that it opened up for people to then think differently about ways of things that was against traditional football thinking and the way that you were supposed to behave or the way you were supposed to build a club. And that was harnessed, I think, that it wasn't just a one-year effect. Like the flow-on effect of that is still lived in Richmond today and will be as you tell stories and it's passed on from generation to generation as all the great stories, whether they've been football, life, culture, they all just get laid in and become a part of who you are, your fabric and your framework. So it was a gateway for Hero, Hardship and Highlight. It was a gateway for really great relationships built on trust and connection rather than just going out and competing together. It was a gateway of love, which is not a word that you associate with sport sometimes, especially men's sport. And that really flicked the switch for us to be the best version of ourselves, but also the most honest version of ourselves, that we weren't being imposters. We weren't trying to fit into we weren't trying to be all perfect little puzzle pieces to fit in to this beautiful little puzzle that's perfect. We were actually our own pieces, and whatever puzzle we came up with was ours. And everyone was proud of that. And it was a real, it was a beautiful thing. And I don't know whether, I don't know if 10 years ago or at the start of my career, I would have spoken about it being culture is a beautiful thing. That's what it was. It was a thing of beauty. It was absolutely beautiful.
How did the love piece affect you guys? Like, how was that used?
So I think it was an acceptance piece of just loving each other. And that's not on a romantic level or the scales of love. There is actually, you know what, I love spending time with you. Or you go out and you do something on the football field. I loved that. It actually made me feel great about myself seeing you do that. Or you picked something up. I picked a bit of rubbish off the ground. I'll give you an example. So Nathan Broad, we played Adelaide and someone got injured from Adelaide and a couple of our boys went over to check on him. He was on the stretcher. And there was a bit of tape on the ground which got bypassed by a couple of Adelaide players, and they might not have seen it or whatever. But Nathan Broad walks past and actually goes and picks that bit up off the ground, and like just the element of picking up off the ground and it goes into a bin. And you look back on that and you go, holy, I love the fact that you did that, Brody, and that makes me love where I work and makes me really proud of where I work and proud of you and proud of who we are. And as a leader, you go, one of our guys did something that is the great reflection on who we are, and we love that and we're extremely proud of that. So it was there was the vehicle of loving each other, but there was also this internal and intrinsic vehicle of loving ourselves and accepting who we were as people and as players and being comfortable with that. And then once we were really comfortable in our own skin, it gave you permission to be yourself around the football club, and you provided yourself with permission to act the way you wanted to act within a certain framework and a set of social rules, which were just sort of non-negotiables really that you have in everyday life when you have human interactions. But it was awesome. And if there was one thing I could bottle up and go back and revisit, that would be it. It would be just going back and sitting in these culture meetings and that point in time where you went in there and you just went in with this sense of excitement because you're in store for something new that day and you're going to learn something about yourself but also about the group.
Vulnerability, I know that you guys did a lot of work with that, and I think you kind of looked at the stuff that Brené Brown had done. I mean, being macho football players, that's the hardest thing for people in your shoes to do. How did that piece affect you?
Yeah, well, I didn't even know who Brené Brown was, and then all of a sudden she was sitting in one of the rooms with us, and it was awesome because male football clubs are really quite male dominated. Mm. So for any female to come in, especially when you go and grab kids from wherever they are in the country. So I'm from nearly the most southern point of the country in Hobart, Daniel Rioli from the Tiwi Islands, Maurice Rioli from the Tiwi Islands, you go and grab them in and you converge them all together. Is that if a really powerful female comes into that room, there's an attraction to be like, because you sort of, you miss your family a little bit and you miss your mum, and then all of a sudden someone comes in and they've got great advice and you're like, oh, you are awesome. And I think we had a real light bulb moment with that, where we just had this, and at the time I had no idea who Brené Brown was. We had this American lady come in with her son and talk about vulnerability and talk about life, and we were just in this state of flow where we were just accepting of everything. We were just like, oh, give us more, give us more, give us more. And this, it just blew our minds. And you talk about that macho-ness of AFL footy, and there's still elements of that now where it's like, it's still a competition and it's a combative sport and you go out and you want to win and whatnot. But we, when the game that Brené came along to, she came into the rooms after and we'd won. A teammate of ours, Alex Rance, who was a very, very funny person, got up and sung a song to Brené. There's a song called Bad, Bad Leroy Brown. And he sang it as Bad, Bad, like Bad, Bad Brené Brown, and then made up these words up. This is in a post-game review 10 minutes after it. And that was like all of a sudden we'd gone from the cauldron of the MCG to Broadway in the space of 10 minutes, and we're getting Brené Brown was being serenaded by Alex Rance to Bad, Bad Leroy Brown. So it was that was a bizarre moment, but it was so funny. It was just, you know, I look back on that and think, like, what an amazing moment to happen, but happen organically. Mm. It was just like the permission and just be allowed to do that was so cool.
What do you think, talking about vulnerability, has been your most vulnerable moment in your footy career?
I've had a few. You know, I think it probably was the 10 seconds before I walked into the room to retire, because there's that acceptance of it's over. Yeah. There's so many things that come along with playing footy that you become institutionalized. I mean, my life revolved around driving up Punt Road, driving home, driving up Punt Road, living on a schedule that was created for me, doing everything for performance, being extremely selfish about how I was preparing, but so driven that you miss things that are going on in your life. And then all of a sudden you flick the switch and it's like, it's literally one sentence. It's like, my time has come. And as soon as you say that, the fireworks go off in your head. It's like, what am I going to do for a job next? How am I going to earn money for my family? Where does this leave me? Like, there's so many little fireworks that fire off and you start asking all these questions that, I mean, that 10 seconds where I was by myself when my Carly and the kids had gone into the room and were waiting for me to come in, like, that's pretty vulnerable. I liken it to, and this is not footy related, but the moment that you sit in before you have a baby. So all our kids are born from C-section, and there's an element of Carly goes in and gets prepped, and there's the medical procedure they need to go to, and you sit there as a father or expecting soon to be father, and you sit in this small white room in scrubs with a red hat on, and you sit there and you're like, right, what's happening in there? And you're like, no one comes in, and you're there for 10 minutes or so, and you go think so many things go through your mind. That's vulnerability there. That's not knowing. That's having the love of your love of your life in having surgery and having really, like, you're about to go on this life-changing experience, but you're sitting there by yourself in this really cold, dark room, and you're just don't know what to think. Mm. That's probably vulnerability for me.
It's so true. You bring up something before, which, you know, I've kind of battled with a bit as well, where, you know, if you've got careers that are flying fast and you're enjoying them, so it's not like you're doing something that you don't like, that you do miss a lot of stuff. I have two kids as well, and I miss a lot of stuff that they do. And I wonder for you how you dealt with that.
Oh, well, I'm still dealing with it now, I think. I've been in a couple of environments of recent times where men in the room have spoken up about being absent fathers and missing out on things.
And then even sometimes when you are present, like I admit I do this, where you've got so much on your mind about work that you know you're not tuned in to like what they're talking about or what they're asking you. Like their joke is that I'm always 10 seconds delayed. They ask me a question. And if I'm not looking at them, they're like, hello.
Yeah.
It makes you laugh, but it does make your heart kind of drop a bit too.
Yeah, and look, I'm on that journey now where I've gone from having my life diarised and scheduled for me for such a period of time that I'm really good at that because it's been ingrained in me that if I've got a diary and things are booked in, I'm really good at turning up But I've had that taken away from me now, where people don't do that for you. And I'm like, right. So I need to teach myself habits about learning to do that better. So I do some work with a productivity sort of expert about how to make time, create space, so that when I need to be on and be the best version of myself. Now, whether that's here in this podcast today, like I made a note at the start of this week, is like my five big rocks of this week is that as I turn up to do interviews like this or do promotion for the book, be the best version of yourself. So I sort of name entertainment really, and I then turn over to maybe I'm working, I do a bit of work for the Tassie government in the football space down there. It's like, what does the best version of yourself look like there? As then when I need to be the best version of myself as a husband or as a father, I'm working on being better at that. Because you never want to get to a point in time where you're like, oh, I've clocked this. Because you never have.
No, you never have.
As your kids grow up, their needs change. They throw more curveballs at you. Your relationships evolve with them. So you need to always be learning. It's just being on top of that and actually being aware, but also making time for it as well, which you'll always be adjusting the needs of things, because some things have higher priority at certain points in time, especially if you're like myself, sort of juggling a few jobs and three kids and a whole bunch of other things, is that if you have a plan, that makes things so much easier. Mm.
Do you still do meditation now?
Yeah, I do. I try and do different things. I think COVID's changed the way people view what I would say left of center ideas, where let's say 5 years ago, pre-COVID, that things may have been seen as like, oh, hippies do that, or there's a bit more of like naturalistic sort of thinking now, especially healing and whatnot. So like I've been really open to stuff like I'm like cold water immersion, Wim Hof breathing. I think meditation is fundamentally just doing something that like you're actually only thinking about that one thing at that point in time, and it's stripping it back. So whether that be breathing, whether that be mindfulness, whether that be jumping in an ice bath, whether that be exercise as well, just getting out and doing something where you can center yourself and be just present with what you are doing at that point in time. And it's something that I'm actually like a really, really passionate about. So like one of my other sort of jobs, we'll call it a job, is running leadership and culture immersions for business. We ask people to lean into these alternative ideas or alternative thinking, non-mainstream or non-corporate ideas, to be the best version of themselves. And that's when you see that work, that's awesome. That's really cool, where you open up a new door for someone or a new pathway where they go, oh, hey, that I've never done it that way before. And that's a new way of thinking. I felt great from that. Even journaling, that's just an element of centering and being mindful about one thing at that point in time.
That's so true. Why did you decide to retire?
Why did I decide to retire? Purely and simply, I loved other things more than I loved footy.
Mm.
That is it. There's little things like my body was failing a little bit, not failing a little bit, but I found it harder to get up. But I just love other things more than I love footy. And that's not to say that I don't love footy. I just love other things more.
You have this beautiful passage in your book, so right at the end. My first ever footy memory is sitting on the shoulders of my dad as we walked up the hill from the Clarence Club rooms to our house on Bellarive Bluff. As this long, beautiful day ends, it's now me and Poppy walking back along Brunton Avenue past the stinky garbage loading bay under the giant metal sculpture near Gate 6 and up the hill to Punt Road with a security guard 10 metres in front of us. I've done this walk hundreds of times by myself, with my teammates, with my coaches, with my club, and now as dusk falls, I hold hands with my daughter and we talk about her goal and running through the banner and singing the theme song in the rooms. And we enjoy this walk together, the first time for her and the last time for me.
That's a pretty cool paragraph, isn't it?
Well, that's right. How you end the book. It's so beautiful.
Probably one of my first ever core memories is sitting on my father's shoulders. We lived at the top of Belle Reve, of King Street, Belle Reve, and at the bottom of one side of the hill was the ground, and at the other side was the social club rooms. And the way I remember it was I sat on Dad's shoulders, my father Chris's shoulders, and walked up the hill, and Dad had got one of the old pewter mugs for a best on ground performance or something like that. And there was a real sense of pride, even as I might have been 3 or 4 at that point, but there was a sense of pride that was my dad. Like, he was my hero and has been my hero for a long period of time now. But there was that sense of achievement, and I just got to relive that again with Poppy, where she's at an amazing age where she's just an absolute information sponge, but she's not influenced by anything else other than what is important to her at that point in time. So there's no news, there's no social media, nothing like that influences what comes out of her mouth. It's purely how she's feeling at that point in time. And she was, all she wanted to talk about was her goal and the fact that she'd been on the MCG and she got to sing the Tigers theme song and the Tigers had had a win, that was the things that were important to her that time. And that was why it was important to me. She's gone on to become I think she goes for the Giants and Collingwood now, which isn't great, but she's been singing the theme song.
How the hell did that happen?
She does calisthenics at 4-year-old kinder, and they play the club's theme songs as a part of the calisthenics. And we were in the post office the other day dropping some stuff off there, and all of a sudden just burst out into the Collingwood theme song and sung it as loud as you possibly could in a room full of people.
You're like, Poppy, this is embarrassing.
No, I was just like, you know what? You can go for who you want.
Bless.
You can go for who you want, but she's just bursting it out, yeah.
Do you have a favourite saying or prayer or mantra?
I like storytelling. That's the big thing for me. Like, I've been told some great stories about climbing Everest and how the last 40 foot is called Hillary Steps. So the story of Sir Edmund Hillary and Tenzing Norgay. And it's the most trickiest, the trickiest part, because, yes, it's hard to climb the last 40 foot. It's also the point where people get and they see the top and it's right within reach. So they forget about the fundamentals of climbing Everest. But I think one that I'm really, really onto at the moment is there's a story about a Chinese farmer who has a horse. The horse runs away and the village come to him and they say, oh, poor you, your horse has run away. You must be feeling so sad. And he goes, oh, well, maybe. And then the horse comes back the next day with 5 other horses. And they say, you're so lucky. You've now got 6 horses. And he says, well, maybe. And then as they're trying to break in the next horse, one of the wild horses, his son falls off and breaks his back. And they say, oh, that's such bad luck. And he says, well, maybe. And then the next day the army rolls into town. They ask every able-bodied man to come on and we'll fight in the war. And his son can't fight, so he stays at home. So you're so lucky your son didn't have to go to war. And he says, well, maybe. And it's always the fact that things can be thrown at you, but you never go on as good as what you think. You never go on as bad as what you think, whether that be in football, in life, in business. There's always something there that's either never get too far ahead of yourself, but never get too down on yourself as well. And, well, maybe.
It reminds me of that nice saying, like, when, you know, you must walk through life moving forward, but you only understand it looking back.
Mm.
I wonder what are some of the things that you now reflect on that you're like, oh, I get why that happened now.
Relationships is the one big thing. The one thing that I'm probably looking at my footy career more than it, so than anything else. I'm really grateful for the fact that, and I say this and I wish we were more successful early on, for the people that were involved in the football club then, that some of them are my good friends, but and didn't get to play in premierships and be successful as fortunate as what I've been and the group of guys that have come through with me. But I look at that and go, it's actually a really great way to have lived your journey as a footballer, is to see the bottom, be unsuccessful, and sort of then start to rise a little bit and have that really peak period of success, but then that little dip again at the end where you get to then go, oh, that was awesome what we got to do, and it gave me a better appreciation of that. Like there's elements of just finishing on a high and being like, oh, what a great way to go out. But just having a tiny little dip at the end where we missed finals a couple of years after we'd won the premiership in 2020. I saw a lot of my best mates retire. I saw the coach that had led us to success finish up. And all those little things, whilst they were sad moments at the time, they're great reflective moments as well. How lucky you have been, how awesome that moment was with that person then. And it gives you, I think it gives you a great recipe to know what you can do when you get everything together and you get everyone pushing in the right direction and how successful you can be. It really is a recipe for success.
What is a life of greatness to you?
Did get prepped with this one as well. I was having coffee with someone this morning and mentioned I was coming on this, and I said, she'll ask you, what does the life of greatness mean to you?
It's a final question in 6 years of podcasting on this podcast that everyone gets asked.
What's a life of greatness? So, or probably what you define greatness as. So do you find that as winning? Do you find that as just getting by? Do you define it as excellence? Probably just define it as, I'm going to say life. Like it's the ups and downs of living everything. So there could, like, you could be really blessed in your life and just roll on through and have no challenging moments, which, I mean, you struggle to find people that don't have challenging moments in their life, but it's actually accepting that you might see every side of it and you might see the sun in every position and you might have lived everything through it. And I think a full life is probably a life of greatness.
Jack Riewoldt, it's so refreshing to see someone that has been in such a male-dominated sports team and area for such a long time talk with such vulnerability and openness, and you sharing your story will help so many millions of other people. You've got your new book that's out, The Bright Side. It's an amazing, amazing read. Thank you so much for the conversation today.
Yeah, thanks for having me, Sarah. I really appreciate it.
If you've enjoyed this episode, then I'd love you to join my community on Instagram at Sarah Grimberg, where we post videos and behind-the-scenes footage of each recording. You can also join my private Facebook group, Live Your Life Greatly, where we discuss the content in this episode and many more, as well as give advice and tips on how to live a life of love and meaning. To purchase my manifestation course and meditations, head to the shop tab at saragrimberg.com or this week's episode show notes to find a link. If you love what you heard, we'd love you to hit subscribe on Apple Podcasts or your favourite podcast app and leave a 5-star review. It will help us share this wisdom with others. Listener.